So let's get started. As I said, this is the grand finale. We have a lot to do. So here's what I'd like to start. Let's go back to the acquisition valuation. I mean, much of what I told was pretty bleak, right? If you look collectively at acquisition, the acquiring company shareholders don't gain much at the time of the announcement of the acquisition. In fact, they lose a little bit. And if you track these acquisitions 5 years, 10 years after the acquisition, most of them don't pay off. So today I'm going to end the acquisition session with a little bit of hopeful news, which you need if you're going to go on to work in M&A, either as a consultant or a banker or in a company that does a lot of M&A. So here's what I'd like to start with, and I'd like your help here on where I can improve my odds. So let's assume that I'm a company that is bent on doing acquisitions. I can't be talked out of it. I'm planning on growing through acquisitions, and I want to go where my odds are going to be the best, where I have the greatest chance of creating that. So I'm going to give you some choices. Some are very simple. I don't think you'll have any trouble picking. Some are a little messy. So if you're an acquiring company and you want to do acquisitions that actually create value, would you rather be a sole bidder or would you be in a bidding war? This is the easy one. Sole bidder or bidding war? Sanjana, Shashanka, everybody kind of agrees. Sole bidder? Yeah, if you're on eBay and you see something you love, you'd rather be the only bidder for it, because if you're in a bidding war, you're going to see the price bid up. We'll come back and look at the actual evidence. It's actually very stark when you get into a bidding war as to what happens to winners of bidding wars versus the losers. Okay, that was easy. Sole bidder. Would you rather go after a public target or a private business? Public or private? That seems to be pretty consensus. Private. Now, let me put one. Adam, can you unmute yourself? Because what is it that makes acquiring public companies so much more difficult? Or BJ? Adam, go ahead. I don't think BJ wants to.
Sure. I think that a lot of the value has already been priced in the public markets.
In other words, with public companies, it's price plus, right? God only knows what's being priced in. In fact, all of it, in fact, 140% of it might be priced in. So private targets are better than public targets, okay? Would you rather pay with cash or pay with stock? This is a tough one. Where do you think the odds are better, paying with cash or paying with stock? And you're allowed to give a conditional answer. Perry, you said stock. I think that's a conditional answer. Tell me what, you know, why paying with stock is better.
Let us assume that you are here to buy my company. If the value on the table is actually real, I would be willing to take stock because I think we'll both grow. But if I'm planning to screw you, I want to take cash and go to Cayman Islands instead.
Really? Rami, do you agree with Perry? Is that the driver for the pay with stock?
I would say that you'd prefer to pay with stock if you believe that your stock price right now is overvalued.
And so, Perry, you're right. There's this game playing with stock and cash. But Rami's, you know, when you think about paying with stock, if you think your stock is overpriced, you're more likely to pay with stock. But here's where the gaming comes in. If I'm a target company and you offer to pay with stock, what should I read into that signal? What do you think about your stock? That it's overpriced, right? So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to hike up the premium. So the question of which wins is an empirical question. So we'll see whether cash or stock is better. Small target or big target? Where do you think the odds are better?
Small.
And what is it about large targets that makes them so difficult to convert to value? Adam says the small is more room for growth. That's true. But large targets also, you get these cultural battles, right? Two big companies come together. They already are set in their ways. You have these case studies, horror stories of two big companies coming together and unable to work out their difference. I still remember when Daimler bought Chrysler. This was a marriage made in hell. You could tell the divorce was coming while the wedding was going on. I mean, that was never, I mean, who thought this was a great idea to take a German automobile company and make it buy a US auto company? Finally, cost synergies or growth synergies? Where do you think the odds are better for you? I see a lot of cost synergies, and that's actually true. So let's actually look at the evidence, because so far it's all hypotheses. Let's start with bidding wars. In a bidding war, there is a winner and there's a loser. There could be multiple losers, but let's say it's a bidding war between two players, winner and loser. And right after the bidding war ends, if you look at the Wall Street Journal headline, it says XYZ company wins bidding war. Let's see who the real winners and losers are in bidding wars. And this is from an interesting study, a fascinating study. Here's what the study looked at. It looked at winners and losers in bidding wars and what happened after the bidding war ended. So day zero is the day the winner gets pronounced, the winner and the loser. And then it tracked what the stock price for the winning bidder and the losing bidder is in the bidding war. So there's the winner. And this is what happened to the stock price. The way to read this is the drop in the stock price in the periods, in the month, in the weeks after, this is actually in weeks, in the weeks after the bidding war ends. So you look at the winner in the bidding war in the weeks after, stock price of the acquirer, you lose almost 30%. That's a pretty hefty loss. The loser in the bidding war actually sees the stock price go up. If you're a shareholder in a company that's in a bidding war, here's what you need to do. Get down on your knees and hope and pray that they lose the bidding war. Because if you win, it's a kind of victory you don't get to celebrate very long because your stock price actually collapses. And there's a simple reason for this. In economics, in auction theory, there's a well-known phenomenon called the winner's curse, which is to win an auction, you tend to overpay. That's what you see in bidding wars. So my advice, if you're an acquirer and you want to grow through acquisition, if you get into a bidding war, drop out right away. Don't even get involved in the back. Let's say if you're better off buying small rather than large. So basically the way to read this graph is you go blue is the smallest, purple is the largest, small to large. And I've looked at how you pay for it, with cash, with stock, with combination. Let's start with the all because that's the most complete list. When you look across all acquisitions, small acquisitions actually create some value. Not a huge amount of value, create value. So small defined as relative to your size. The way to read this is less than 5%. The target company is less than 5% of your size in market cap terms. That's a blue. 5 to 10 is the red, not bad. 10 to 20, it's starting to get bad. And more than 20%, you can see that the losses are worse. So across all mergers, it's better to buy small rather than large. Mergers of equals are almost destined to fail. But there's a very interesting dichotomy between cash and stock on the size of the target. If you're buying a small target, it's better to pay with stock. If you're buying a large target, it seems to be that your odds are much better when you pay with cash. And this goes back to what I talked about earlier, which is this gaming system, which is if you're trying to buy a large company, let's say when Disney bought Fox, they'd offer to pay entirely with shares. If I were the Murdochs, I'd have pushed up my premium by 10 or 15%. Reason being, the very fact that you're paying with shares is a signal to me that you think your stock is overpriced. And if that is the case, instead of demanding a 30% premium, I should demand a 45% premium. That seems to happen more when you have large targets and with small targets. So if you're buying small targets, then it looks like that stock pays off. But if you buy large targets, cash seems to be the much better way to pay for it. But overall though, it's better to buy small rather than large. Let's talk about public versus private. I'm sorry, go ahead, Jonathan.
Can you just explain that theory one more time? Why one would think that the stock is overpriced if they pay with stock?
Well, remember, if you think through it, so let's see, do you want to be the target company or the acquiring company? Take a role. You want to be the target company?
Sure.
I'll be the acquiring company. I come and offer you a price. And then I say, oh, by the way, I want to pay entirely with shares. But the very fact that I'm paying with shares tells you something, right? Which is that I must think my shares are cheap. Because if I thought my shares were undervalued, would I ever pay with shares?
What about if you don't have a large cash balance, though?
Well, I can still raise cash, right?
Yeah, okay.
So it's not a question because one way or the other, I have to raise cash for this acquisition. Shares are just a shortcut to get that. I could have issued the shares, taken the cash, and used it to buy them. But even if I'm cash poor, if my shares are undervalued, I'm going to be very reluctant to do this deal. So the very fact that I'm using shares is signaling to you, at least, it might not be a perfect signal, but it's a signal that I think my shares are at least not undervalued. They might be overvalued or perhaps fairly valued. and you read into that signal, you push up your target, you push up your premium.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's talk about public versus private. So I want you to compare the blue to the red. Blue are the public targets, red are the private targets. Again, I've broken it down by size of the target. With very small acquisitions, it's not that much of a deal, but clearly it's still prefer a private to a public. I'll come back to the green in a moment. But as the deals get larger, it gets more and more difficult to actually create value with public targets. By the time you get to the biggest deals, look at the payoff that you get. It's minus 3%. Whereas private targets do much better. You're saying, what's the green column? The green column is actually even better than the private targets. And what are those? Those are subsidiaries of public companies. Your very best target in an acquisition is not even a private company. It's a subsidiary of a public company. You know what I'm talking about? Recently, there was talk about Boeing selling off its portion of its defense business. Why is it doing it? Because it's desperate. It wants to get rid of that target. So when you see subsidiaries being sold by public companies, it's often either because they're desperate for cash or because a new CEO has come in and that CEO wants to get rid of the mistakes of the old guy at any price. Now, if you're familiar with Tata Motors, Tata Motors' best investment in the last decade was an acquisition of Jaguar Land Rover from Ford because Ford was desperate to get rid of Jaguar Land Rover. How desperate? In 2009, they'd have sold Jaguar Land Rover for pretty much any price. Tata Motors took advantage of it. So private is better than public because you don't have the market price plus, but subsidiaries of public companies are even better than private companies because the people selling them don't even seem to care what price they sell them at. So you can see already why an acquisition strategy of just going and buying public companies and paying a premium on the market price, especially if you do large acquisitions, is almost destined for doom. Any questions, Shashanka?
Yeah, so the smaller companies being better acquisitions, actually that logic doesn't hold here. Is that because whatever impact acquiring a private company or a subsidiary has, it's just magnified when you're a larger company?
Exactly.
So there's more value created.
Exactly. I think, and also the potential for synergy to be enough to justify the premium is much greater when you buy a small company, right? If a Microsoft buys a small publicly traded software company, all it needs is a glimmer of synergy to show up in the combined company to cover the premium that you pay. Whereas if you go out and buy Adobe, think of how much premium you will need to earn to justify that. So as the deals get larger, it gets more and more difficult to get enough synergy in the combined company, even if it exists, to cover the premium.
Yeah, sorry, what I meant in my question is in the this chart that you're showing, it is showing that the larger acquisitions is...
Are you talking about when you pay with cash?
The next chart, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, this
the larger one. Acquisitions, so tell me what you see.
So in larger acquisitions, if you acquire private or subsidiaries, your stock price return is better.
But it's across the board, in all three, in every single grouping, right? It's just less bad. The difference is smaller when you have really small acquisitions. But even at the smallest target companies, private companies are better than public companies and subsidiaries. The ranking remains the same, no matter what the size is. It's just the divergence gets larger and larger as you get to really big companies.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Finally, cost synergies versus growth synergies. And this is from a McKinsey study that looked at cost savings after mergers and revenue synergies. So in the left, you have revenue synergies. In the right, you have cost synergies. As a percentage of what was promised at the time of the merger. So 100% would be you deliver exactly what you promised. If you look at cost synergies, 36 out of the 92 companies that had promised cost synergies delivered more than 100%. 25 delivered 91 to 100%. So cost synergies with about 16 out of the 92, two-thirds of the sample delivered almost all of what they promised as cost synergies. In contrast, look at growth synergies. When you look at revenue synergies, only 30. So if you do the same measures that we did for costs, 30 out of the 77 were able to deliver, and 23 delivered less than 30% of the promised synergy. at least in practice, it's much more difficult to deliver on revenue synergies than cost synergies because A, it's a lot more work, and B, you can't plan for it as well before you do the merger. So for acquisitions to create value, you have to be disciplined. You got to find out what works for you, and you have to stay disciplined with that. You also have to know when to stop. I mean, I might have given you the example of Cisco, one of the best examples of a company that grew through acquisitions well in the 1990s. Its market cap went from $4 billion to $400 billion, entirely driven by acquisition after acquisition. In fact, Harvard Business School used it as a case study of how acquisitions can create value, which is, it's a death knell for your strategy when Harvard Business School targets your strategy as a strategy that works. Because between 2000 and 2010, Cisco continued to do exactly what they did in the 1990s, and their market cap went from $400 billion down to $100 billion. There's a point at which acquisitions stop working, and knowing when to stop is part of the process of discipline. But here's the problem, though. As you grow through acquisitions and you're successful, you get bigger. As you get bigger, you have to do more acquisitions just to stay in place, and that gets more and more difficult as you get bigger and bigger as a company. So overall, can you create value with acquisitions? Yes, it's a lot more work than with internal projects. And the odds get much worse for you if you're buying large companies, large public companies, as opposed to private businesses and subsidiaries. So there is hope here, but you've got to stay disciplined. Any questions on acquisitions before we move on to value enhancement?
Going back to cash versus stock. If you think your stock is overpriced, wouldn't it be better if you're acquiring a big one to pay with stock rather than cash?
The target also knows. So they'll negotiate for each higher premium. This is not a game where you know what is true about your stock and the other side is done. If it's a large target company, they're being advised by consultants and bankers that they're paying with shares, that must mean they're overpriced. So that dance doesn't seem to end well for the acquiring company. So everybody kind of can read the signal. With small companies, they might not care. With large companies, they care a lot. I mean, there's no way Rupert Murdoch is taking Disney's stock if Disney's offering to pay entirely with checks. There's also a tax issue, a personal tax issue, which is when you pay with cash, you know, stockholders have to pay taxes right away. When you pay with stock, the basis can get transferred to the new shares and you can delay paying capital gains taxes. So there's a side tax issue as well, which can drive which one a target company will accept in an acquisition. Did that answer your question, Julieta?
I was just wondering what's the best criteria to like realize when is better?
Don't assume the other side is stupid. Everything you do, the other side sees, and they draw their signaling from it. You can't operate in a world where you say, I have the information, the other side is stupid, so I can do whatever I want. Whatever you do will create a counter reaction. And I'm saying in a large acquisition, the very fact that you're trying to pay with shares is a signal to the target company. They're going to adjust what they demand accordingly. So now let's talk about value enhancement. Before I go into value enhancement, I have to explain what I'm not going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about price enhancement. Now, we've talked a lot about value and price, but these two sets of graphs, I think, bring home the difference more than anything I could have said about price versus value. So the first graph that you see to the left is actually a study from the late 1990s. And you know what it did? It looked at companies that changed their names. The title of the study was A Rose by Any Other Name. So they looked at about 60 or 65 companies that changed their names. They said, what's a big deal? Companies change their names all the time. These companies changed their names in a very specific way. They added .com to their names. Remember, this is the peak of the .com boom. They're adding .com to their names. And this study actually made sure that the companies didn't change. They were doing exactly the same thing after the name changes before. And it looked at what happened to the stock price on the announcement of the name change. It's actually astonishing. The price of these companies that added .com to their names jumped 150% on the announcement. Look at that, 150%. You see, we wasted our time in this class talking about cash flows, growth, and risk. We should be talking about good names. But just to show you the danger, so this is, there's no value change, but the price obviously is up. You say, what's the second graph? The second graph looked at, it's about 6 years later, I think 2002 or 2003, looked at companies that also changed their names. Remember, this is now the dot-com boom is busted. Having dot-com to your names is now a deadly sign. You know what these companies did? They removed dot-com from their names. So when they removed dot-com from their names, guess what the stock price did again? It went up again. What I'm trying to say is, I'm not suggesting that you focus all your attention on name changes, but when a CEO says, I want to increase my value as a company, ask them an honest question. Do you want to increase your value or do you want to increase your price? Because what you need to do to increase price might be cosmetic things, spin-offs, split-offs, you know, creating tracking stock. And companies have done this over time, created these symbolic things, stock dividends, most useless thing ever. But people think it'll affect your stock price, and maybe it does. So price enhancement, I can't tell you what to do because it depends on what the market values and giving the market what it wants. But I do know what causes value to change. In fact, we all do. We've spent this entire class talking about it. There are only four ways I can change the value of a company. And as I say this, it's going to sound incredibly simplistic if you look at, you know, if you look at what I'm going to say. So to increase the value of a company, I have to A, increase the cash flows from existing assets by doing what? Cutting costs, being more efficient, increase cash flows from existing assets. Second, maybe I can increase the value from future growth by either investing more if I'm in a good business or investing less if I'm in a bad business. Maybe I can increase my excess returns and how long I can keep those excess returns by building up my competitive advantages. Or maybe I can reduce my cost of capital. Increase cash flows, increase value from growth, reduce my discount rate, and increase the length of my growth period. Sounds incredibly simplistic, but everything you see in a restructuring is somewhere in that. Let's talk about increasing cash flows from existing assets. And if you hear words that you see in restructuring, it's deliberate. When you hear companies talk about more efficient operations and cutting costs, what I hear from a valuation perspective is higher margins. Same revenues, higher margins, you get higher operating income. If you're selling businesses that are money losing, but and you expect them to lose money forever, what I hear is your operating income as a company will be higher going forward. I know this is going to sound incredibly unpatriotic, but hang it. I'm sorry, go ahead. Julieta?
No, my bad, sorry.
Okay. What I'm going to say next is going to sound unpatriotic, but kind of cut me some slack. I have never believed that it should be the objective of any company to maximize taxes paid to the government. But let me be very quick to cover myself. Within the structure of the law, I think it's my job to minimize taxes paid. And if I can reduce my tax rate as a company, my effective tax rate, what do I get? I get higher after-tax operating income and higher cash flow. I can reduce my tax rate by having income in lower tax locales. Tech companies have become masters of playing this game. There's a reason Google has put YouTube as an Irish subsidiary. It's transfer pricing. If any of you worked in transfer pricing, I know you have all these glorious objectives. When I hear the word transfer pricing, all I can think about is you're trying to save taxes. And finally, risk management. I'm not a great fan of it, but one of the benefits you get from risk management is you might be able to lower your tax rate over time. All of those things increase your after-tax operating income. If you've over-invested in the past, you can live off that investment for a while, which means your CapEx can be much lower, higher cash flows. And finally, if you're a company with significant working capital needs, managing that working capital better will increase your cash flows. Samir?
Yep. Your voice broke a little bit when you talked about Google and YouTube. What did you say there about the two companies?
Well, Google has YouTube as an Irish entity. I mean, I might be wrong, but there's a portion of Google that is hived off that has an Irish. I have to check, but I think one reason for companies having with the new tax law, they might have brought it back to the mainland, but before the tax law changed, the US tax rate 40%. I mean, many of the tech companies had their online businesses structured in such a way that the revenues were delivered to cheap, lower tax locales.
Okay, perfect. And Ireland in this case is a
12%
tax. Okay.
And your argument is when I sell stuff online, I'm selling it into hyperspace. It's not physically, it's much more difficult for GM to do this, right? Your cars, I can see exactly where you sell them. But if you're a tech company, you know, where am I buying your products from? When I'm subscribing to Skype, where exactly are those revenues being collected? So it becomes easier for companies that sell online and sell intangible products to essentially reduce their taxes by playing the geography game.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, Julia.
Would it be smart to just base a strategy on tax planning?
I think it would be extraordinarily dangerous for two reasons. One is tax laws change all the time. So you created an entire company on the difference between US tax rates and the rest of the world. In 2018, your business would have imploded. That's one problem. The second is, it's very difficult to justify to the world why your company should exist if the only reason you're doing it is to save taxes, right? So it becomes a very difficult story. You say, who cares what story you tell? Because you will need the public's goodwill at one time or the other. One reason the cruise line companies are in such trouble right now is for as long as they've been around, the decades I've tracked them, they've all been Liberia-based or Panama-based. Why? Because they didn't want to pay taxes. Now they need bailouts. And guess what? No government wants to step in and bail them out. So building an entire, if tax benefits are a side benefit, it's okay. But if it's a central reason for existence, I think you're in big trouble. Let's talk about value creation from growth. If you're in a good business, in other words, a business that you can generate returns on capital that exceed the cost of capital, you can increase value by either reinvesting more, finding more projects with that high return on capital, or reinvesting better by pushing up your return on capital. So if you're in a good business, maybe the value creation comes from more growth, pushing for more growth. But if you're in a bad business where your return on capital is less than your cost of capital, and if you remember that graph we saw way back in time, you know, 60% of companies globally earn less than their cost of capital. Your path to value creation might not be to grow faster, but to grow slower. In fact, even shrink. So the bottom line is you don't want to glorify growth for the sake of growth. It depends on how that growth is being created. So you can increase cash flows from existing assets. You can try to go for higher value from growth. The third is you can build competitive advantages. As you well know, I'm not a corporate strategy guy. I think strategy is often a buzzword, but this is the place where good strategy meets value. Because when I hear the word strategic advantages, what I hear are ways to earn more than your cost of capital. So very simply, let's suppose you have no competitive advantages. You know what, where that's going to show up? Your margins are going to shrink towards whatever the industry average is. It's going to be very difficult for you to earn more than your cost of capital. So if you have no competitive advantages, you want to try to find some. And if you have existing competitive advantages, you don't want to let them slip away. So as I said, you can have hundreds and hundreds of competitive advantages. Let me list the four that I think are the most significant. The first is branding. Let's face it, brand name is one of the longest and most sustainable competitive advantages known to human beings, simply because we don't know where it comes from. It's this combination of, it's not just advertising. Companies spend millions and billions in advertising and have nothing to show for it. But I remember Snapple coming out of nowhere, Crocs coming out of nowhere, and essentially finding a brand name advantage. Lululemon, no, where did that come from? Brand name is a competitive advantage that can last a long time. So if you have a brand name, preserve it. Don't let it waste away. Don't have the wrong celebrity pushing your brand name. No. And if you don't have a brand name, try to find a way to create a brand name. When I look at Uber and Lyft, one of the things I see them struggling to do is try to create some kind of competitive advantage. I don't know whether the brand name can do it, but you want to create the brand name. Second is, maybe you can get protection from competition. Wouldn't it be nice if the government where you're enforcing kept the competitors out? That's essentially what you get with patents. To the degree that you can get protection from competition, go out and get it. The only thing you got to be careful about is sometimes governments, in return for giving you protection against competition, take away your pricing power. You know what I'm talking about, right? If you're a phone company, a power company, you're granted a monopoly. It's called a regulated monopoly. But they take away your pricing power. To which your response is, no, thank you. Because then you get all of the disadvantages of being a monopoly. Everybody hates you. But none of the advantages. You say, what's the advantage of being a monopoly? Well, if everybody hates you, you know how you get back at them? You increase your price 300%, then take that. You can't even do that if you're a regulated monopoly. Switching costs. To me, in technology businesses, this is perhaps one of the most interesting competitive advantages. You know what switching costs are? Basically, you want to make the cost of switching into your product as low as possible. Walk in, I'll give you my new cell service. But once people switch in, you want to make the cost of switching out as high as possible. Technology companies wrestle with switching, creating switching costs that work in their favor. Microsoft, if you think about how it's become the company it is, especially the Office and Windows days, was switching costs. Basically, the cost of switching into Microsoft from, I remember when I switched from Lotus 1-2-3, that tells you how old I am, to Microsoft Excel. It was costless and it was overnight. But once I switched into Excel and they brought in Word and PowerPoint into the mix, I was trapped. I could not switch out. So today, I have so much stuff in PowerPoint, Word, and Excel. I can never. I mean, even if I like Apple's new products, I can't switch. And finally, cost advantages. If you have a cost advantage as a company, there are two ways you can take advantage of that cost advantage. The first is you can charge less than everybody else and drive the rest of your competitors out, or you can charge about what everybody else does and walk away with much bigger margins. That's how Dell won the PC game in the 1990s, before Lenovo had lower cost than Dell. So cost advantages, eventually you end up losing, but when you have them, that's one of two. In fact, today you look at oil companies, Aramco has a dramatic cost advantage over everybody else. And they didn't know it. They were endowed with that cost advantage. And it'd be interesting to see how they play that cost advantage game because, I mean, there's only so much oil under the ground. So when you talk about improving competitive advantage.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
When doing that analysis of those items, how do you differentiate between how those items are contributing to an increase in operating margins and how those items are contributing to an interesting in return on capital?
It's almost impossible to do. That's why when accountants say we're going to put brand name on the balance sheet, my reaction is really, for Coca-Cola, you might, because that's your only competitive advantage. But if you try that with Apple, as you pointed out, how do I know how much of Apple's margin is due to brand name? How much to switching costs? No, it's almost impossible to do. That's why, and thank God in valuation, we don't have to do it. Accountants, though, have to deal with this, and it's a hole they dug for themselves, but it's almost impossible to do.
Yeah, no, my question is specifically when different, because you mentioned an increase in return on capital. Mm-hmm. How do you differentiate between what's contributing to increased return on capital?
As an investor, it doesn't matter. As long as it's there, you benefit from all of these competitive advantages. So when you assess a company, you're looking at how the bundle of competitive advantages the company has will do over time. It's only accountants who have to split out which competitive advantage is causing what, right? Because they're now given this mission of tell me how much brand name is worth, how much legal protection is worth. And as I said, I would never embark on that mission. It's almost an impossible mission. But as investors, you get the complete bundle. So I think, since you pay for the stock and you get the bundle of competitive advantages with it, I don't see why we need to unbundle it.
Another quick question.
Yeah.
If you were an operator and you're facing a decision early on in like a tech product to encourage higher switching costs versus mm-hmm. taking, say, the value of your product now by making it less sticky, charging people for it, like mm-hmm. in the case of Zoom recently,
yep.
how would you, I can understand how you'd go about valuing the cash flows, obviously. How would you value the switching costs?
I think with Zoom, especially when you bring the subscription model into play, I think you want to go for more users because you know that now after this, even if you have a low price, if you have 10 times more users, that payoff is going to be much greater than anything. If you are a transaction-based company, I think that it's a tougher call. If you're a subscription-based company, I think both with Peloton and with Zoom, my advice to them is give the product away for free because those people, to the extent that they will now become long-term subscribers, not just a one-time transaction, long-term subscribers, the payoff yeah. is going to be much greater. I mean, if you want to make it more explicit, you'd have to value a subscriber. and then look to see what it costs you to give that subscription, give that service away for free for 4 to 6 months. And I don't even think it'll be close. I valued an Uber rider at $450 per rider in terms of value. That's a lot of free rides you can get. So I think that that's the same way I would do this. I value subscriber, look at how much it costs Zoom or Peloton. Remember, the cost is close to zero of having an extra subscriber, maybe additional service space. But I think that given that trade-off, my guess is that going for giving free subscriptions out now is an incredibly good business judgment in terms of creating value. Not to mention the fact that it gets you a lot of goodwill as well.
Right. So you'd value higher subscribers, almost zero subscriber acquisition costs, and then larger ARPU, but at a longer time in the future.
Exactly.
Got it.
I think it's different if you're a company where adding those subscribers creates real costs for you that you cannot back out of if they leave.
Right.
Right. So that would be problematic, is if you're setting up a service where there's a real cost. That's why a lot of grocery stores haven't set their own delivery services. Right, the logistics of buying the trucks and hiring people, that's not easy to back out of. So it tells you why some companies have been able to scale up quickly and some companies have not been very reluctant to do it.
Got it, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, so finally, let's talk about the fourth way. So you can increase cash flows, increase value from growth, maybe build up competitive advantages, or reduce your cost of capital. When I talk about reduced cost of capital, if you've been in for my corporate finance class, if you remember, you can change the debt ratio. You can reduce it. By doing that, perhaps you can reduce your cost of capital. But remember, there are three other ways you can reduce your cost of capital. One is, again, from a corporate finance class, if you remember, matching debt up to your assets reduces default risk. So maybe you can have debt that's more matched to your assets. That will reduce your cost of debt and your cost of capital. But there are two sideways in reducing the cost of capital that go back to what drives betas. Remember we said your product or service is more discretionary, you have a higher beta? Maybe you can do something to make your product or service less discretionary. I mean, one of the things that cell phone service companies have done so well is you can reach a point where cell service is no longer a discretionary product. So by modifying your product or service to make it less discretionary, you've in a sense reduced your beta and reduced your cost of equity. Alternatively, you have a lot of fixed cost and you can bring down your operating leverage. Effectively, again, you've lowered your beta, lowered your cost of equity, lowered your cost of capital. The reason I bring these other ways of reducing cost of capital is many people, when you say, I want to reduce my cost of capital, they immediately jump to the debt mix. That's only one of four ways. Look at other ways of reducing the cost of capital that might not require that you go to a 30 or 40% debt ratio, because that lower cost of capital translates into a higher value. So now let's bring those four levers into play to talk about the value of control. Earlier when we talked about acquisitions, we talked about 20% control premiums. And I told you where those come from looking at databases. But the true value of control comes from two elements. The first is, that you can, the property that you can change the management of an existing company. So I came to you with a company, you got to first change the management to be able to change the way the company is run. The second is what you will gain by changing the way the company is run. You say, what does that even mean? When I value a company, I can value it twice. Once with the status quo, the existing management running the company, and once with you running the company. That difference is really the value of control. But to do this, I've got to be able to change the company. So the probability of changing the management comes into play. So here's the bottom line. If you have a company that's already really well run, the value of gaining control will be small or even non-existent. If you have a company that's badly managed and badly run, your potential for creating value is much, much greater. So the value of control cannot be 20%. It could be 0% for some companies, 50% for others, 100% for others. So I'm going to show you a very simple example of how to value control and how this can help you in lots of different places. So about 10, 11 years ago, I was asked to come in and do a valuation seminar in Croatia. And I wanted to value a Croatian company. And I'll be quite honest, no great Croatian companies came to mind. So literally, here's what I did. I went to a Bloomberg terminal. I closed my eyes. I asked for a listing of Croatian companies, touched the screen, and picked a company at random. Company called Adris Grupa. Adris Grupa is a Croatian tobacco company. So far that way, it's a tobacco company, it's a mature company. It's growing pretty aggressively. It was reinvesting about 71% of its after-tax operating income and earning a 9.69% return on capital. That doesn't look bad, right? 9.69%. But that return on capital is in Croatian kuna. In fact, this entire valuation was in Croatian kuna. And our risk group's cost of capital was about 10.55%. So I'm going to describe a risk group to you. And what I want you to think about is what you would change if you ran a risk group. So basically, Adris Grupa is a growing company. It's growing at about 7% a year, growing by taking investments that earn a return on capital of about 9.7%, lower than the cost of capital. And it's funded almost entirely with equity. It's a tobacco company. Remember, tobacco companies have solid, stable cash flows. Usually, they should be able to borrow money. But Adris Grupa is run by a family group that doesn't like to borrow money. It's 97% equity, 3% debt. So I sat down to value the company, May 1st of 2010, and I did the traditional cash flows, but I left everything as is. I let them continue to invest in these products. Why? Because they've been doing it forever. They don't think it's a problem. I locked them into continuing with that investment policy. I locked them into continuing with 97% equity, 3% debt, saying, hey, they run the company, I don't. And I got a value for the equity of 5,484 million. That is with the existing management running the company. Let me ask you a question. You ran the company, what are some of the changes you could make? Well, first, you might consider using a little more debt. I'm not going to ask you to go crazy and do a leveraged buyout, but you could use a little more debt. It's a tobacco company. You should have stable cash flows. And second, clearly, this is value destructive. I mean, is it asking for too much that they take zero net present? I don't even want positive net present value, but could you stop at zero net present value projects, which means you'd want a return on capital roughly equal to the cost of capital? So I'm going to make two changes in Adris Grupa. First, I used about 10% debt. Remember I told you I wasn't going to go crazy? Their optimal debt ratio is actually closer to 30%. I said, don't even go to 30%. This is Croatia. You want some buffer. Go to 10%. Very slight, small drop in the cost of capital. But I also said, please stop taking bad net present, negative net present value projects. At least take zero NPV projects. You're saying, what if there are no zero NPV projects? And then don't take projects. That's the same thing. If you can earn your cost of capital on your projects and have a slightly lower cost of capital, the value that I get is 5,735 million. So if you remember on the previous page, I got 5,484. That's the status quo value. With minimal changes, I get 5,735. Think, why do I need these two values? That difference of about 249 million kuna is essentially the value of control in Adris Grupa. Now, do you see how you can do this with any company? If I took a company like Microsoft, that is well regarded, really well run, and I did this analysis, the difference in values I get is going to be really, really, really small. But if I take a company like HP that has a reputation of being much more randomly run, bad stuff happens, the difference in values can be 30, 40, or 50%. So you don't have, I mean, obviously I didn't ask you to do this on your project, but you have the platform from which you can answer this question now. What is the value control in my company? By valuing the company twice, once with the status quo, and once with new management in place, perhaps you in place. That requires a bit of an ego, but develop that ego because that is where the value control comes from. It's actually funny because I gave this talk to a group of Delaware court judges, and Delaware court judges is where all the M&A cases land up. So they were in UPenn for a seminar, and they said, can you come in and talk about control premiums? And they didn't mention it to me, but Bill Ackman was also one of the invited guests. So I actually gave this talk before Bill got on and talked about where he got went for control. It was interesting because he then talked about specific companies and the judges could see where the increase in value came from with that specific company. Are there any questions on the value control or the structure of the value control? Justin asked a question, would the reinvestment rate come down? Yeah, I could make the reinvestment rate 10% and I'd get the same value because this is almost, at this point, growth that is neutral. So you can make the reinvestment rate 10, 20, or 30, or even 0%. That's why I said, if you don't have any zero net present value projects, just don't invest. The growth rate will go down, but the cash flows will go up. Remember, Sammy, who was it that asked about, So as you said, the growth, actually, the growth will go to zero if I reinvest zero, but then my cash flows will be my entire after-tax operating income. And if your growth is not creating value, the cash flow effect will dominate the growth effect.
Question.
Yep.
The difference in the values, do you divide it over the total number of shares or you divide it on the voting?
We're going to come back to that. I'll come back to that because I'm going to talk about what you would divide by. Because Perry's asking a good question. I have two values. Now, what do I do with the value control? And I'm going to give you four different places where that value control can be useful.
Do you have the value of the equity if you had chosen the optimal debt to equity ratio?
I'll come back to that because the problem with this particular company is you have two classes of shares, voting and non-voting shares. And I'm going to argue that how the shares will get the control would depend on whether you're looking at the voting or the non-voting shares. But if you're only one class of shares, I would just take the change in value and divide by the total number of shares. So the equity value would go up by almost, you know, by the same dollar value, but by a higher percentage amount. So let's talk about how this value control is going to play out. Okay? In a hostile acquisition, this value control is the maximum you can pay for a target company. So you don't want to pay the entire amount. So I don't see how you can do hostile acquisition. Talk about control premiums if you don't actually explicitly value control. So one of the dead giveaways that an acquisition strategy is ill thought through is you'd see people talk about the value control, but if you ask them, where's the value control coming from? They haven't thought through what they would change in the target company. You can't do that. So with hostile acquisitions, if your control is the reason for the acquisition, I want to see two valuations. In publicly traded firms, here's how the value control plays out. If you think about the market's not stupid. So when it looks at a badly managed company, it builds in a probability that that company's management could change. As I said, markets are very nuanced in what they build in the market price. So let's say you have a badly managed company. There's a status quo value. But the market says, look, there's a 60% chance control could change here. The market price will already reflect some of the value control. Now do you see why doing acquisitions and paying a premium on top of the market price can get you into trouble? For all you know, the market's already been building in an 80% chance that change will happen. Now you pay a big premium on top of that market price. You're almost destined to fail. So when you look at the market price of a stock, it already incorporates a probability of management change. That's why when a Carl Icahn shows up as a stockholder in a company, you see the stock price jump. Why? Because the probability of management changing just went up. So with publicly traded firms, I'm going to argue the market price already has some component of the expected value control. With voting and non-voting shares, I think knowing the value control can give you a way of coming up with a premium for voting shares. Because, you know, we all kind of understand intuitively that voting shares should trade at the premium over non-voting shares. Why? Because you get some share of the control. Now, the way bankers do it is they say, well, looking at other voting and non-voting shares, there's a 7% premium, we're going to add that on. That sounds like a bludgeon. So I'm going to talk about how the expected value of control can play out in voting and non-voting shares. And finally, in private companies, there's something called a minority discount. Saying, what's a minority discount? Let's say you own a private business, and you offer to sell me 51% of the business. I'll pay a certain amount for that business. But if you offer me 49% of exactly the same business, I'm going to discount the value significantly. And here's why. When I own 51% of a business, I control the business. I can change the way it's run. When you sell me 49%, you own the remaining 51%, I have no control. So the value control is going to let me know how much of a discount I should offer if you give me 49% as opposed to 51%. So I'm going to use this voting, non-voting share example, and I'm going to go back to our Driss group. If you remember, I came up with two values, right? 5,484 and 5,735. Our Driss group had 6.75 million non-voting shares and 9.6 million voting shares. So first, I'm going to value the non-voting shares. That's the easiest scenario. Here's my argument. When you own non-voting shares, you're stuck with the status quo. It's a very extreme scenario. Hang in there with me. I'm saying as a non-voting shareholder, there's nothing you can do. You can't change management, you can't vote. So here's what I did. I took the status quo value, 5,484 million, divided by the total number of shares outstanding and came up with 334 kuna. I said if all shares were part of the status quo, the value per share would be 334 kuna. That was my value per non-voting share. You see, what do I get as a voting shareholder? You get a say in whether the company is run differently. So I took the 249 million, which is what you get by running the company differently, and gave it just to the voting shareholders. I know it's an extreme scenario because I'm dividing the value of control and giving it entirely to the voting shareholders. But if I do that, the value per share is 362. In reality, the difference will be smaller because non-voting shares can piggyback on voting share if change actually happens. But if you have acquisitions, whether it's a two-tier offer, you don't know what two-tier offers are, basically the acquirer can pay one price for one class of shares and a much lower price for the other class. The voting shares are going to walk away with the bulk of the spoils in an acquisition. I'll tell you from personal experience, this happens because about 20 years ago, I was a stockholder in a Brazilian company called Ambev. It's still around, but then Ambev got acquired by a Belgian brewer called Inbev. Names were very similar. And I thought this was going to be my payday as a stockholder in Ambev. But it turned out that I owned the preferred shares, which are the non-voting shares. My premium was 3%. The common stockholders actually got an 80% premium. Sounds unfair, but as long as the two-tier offers are allowed, the voting shareholders walk away with the difference. So already you can see that the difference between voting shares and non-voting shares is going to be a function of two things. One is how well the companies run. In well-run companies, the premium should be much smaller. In badly run companies, the premium should be much larger. And the second is the probability that you can change the management of the company. If there's zero chance of changing the management, then there'll be no difference between voting and non-voting shares. If there's 100% chance, then the difference is going to be the entire value of control. Now you can see why Facebook voting and non-voting shares trade at roughly the same price. Google's voting and non-voting shares trade at roughly the same price. But Viacom's voting and non-voting shares trade at very different prices. Something to keep in mind when you look at the premium for voting as opposed to non-voting shares. Shashanka?
So you said the public stock price is already priced in a bit of control premium. Is that because public investors already kind of price in possibility of someone coming in and
That's why when a call icon shows up as a stockholder in a company, nothing's changed. Right? Your value hasn't changed yet, but you'll see the price up because the probability of change just went up because an activist investor showed up.
Okay, thank you.
Now, if you, I don't know how many of you are planning to go into consulting, McKinsey, Bain, BCG, Deloitte, wherever you go. One of the things, especially the most lucrative part of consulting is what's called value consulting. What's value consulting is when a company calls you and says, I want to increase my value as a company. What should I do? Most of the time, the company just wants to increase its price and you tell them, you just change your name, add.com, take.com out, do whatever you need to do. But if they're truly interested in value creation, they want your advice. And of course, you could use the DCF. Nothing we've done in the DCF is rocket science, right? It's basically understanding the basics of value. But consulting firms have discovered that when you tell the CEOs to maximize value and you offer them the DCF framework, they find it too complex. Why? There are too many moving parts, too many assumptions. They want something simpler. So they, you know, what they want is just focus on this variable and everything's going to work out for you. Focus. And it used to be things like, you know, return on invested capital or increased market share. But consulting firms have also discovered that creating their own proprietary measure and giving it an acronym, you know, Stern Stewart in the 1990s, a big consulting firm, created this acronym called EVA, Economic Value Added. I'm going to show you how it's measured, and you're going to very quickly see that there's nothing there. Holt Associates, another consulting firm, came up with CFROI. You know, I think it, you know, Deutsche Bank came up with its own. But essentially, what these consulting firms do is they offer these acronyms to companies. So Stern Stewart would go to companies and say, this DCF stuff is too complicated. Use EVA instead. And CEOs loved it because you were giving them a number. They said, focus on this number and everything's going to be okay. And sometimes consulting firms overreach. They argue that using this acronym actually will give you a more precise value, a better value than going with the traditional DCF model. I won't go into the details, but that's absolutely not true. In fact, I don't want to spend too much time on the mechanics of it, but if you value a company using a DCF and you value it using CFROI or EVA or any other approach, if you do it right, you will get the same value for the company. And the problem is if you adopt this metric as a shortcut And that's what companies did in the 1990s with EVA, where they attach how much managers got paid by what EVA they created. Then you're asking for trouble, because there are lots of perverse ways in which you can increase your market share, increase your EVA, increase profitability, and in the process, reduce the value of your company. That's what makes it perverse. And when you reward managers based on EVA or CFROI or market share, you're asking for trouble, because they're going to put those metrics ahead of increasing value. So I don't have a problem with adopting these shortcut metrics, but they're shortcuts, and they can lead to some serious game playing on the part of managers. If you get a chance, read the section I have in EVA in my book or in my lecture notes, because I point out some of the perverse games that companies played in the 1990s to make their EVA look higher. I'll give you one very simple example. EVA is return on capital minus cost of capital multiplied by capital invested. That's it. That's the entire measure. Return on capital minus cost of capital times capital invested. So one of the ways you can make a company's EVA much higher is by having less capital invested. So in the 1990s, one of the mistakes people were making, and they were making it almost for another 15 years, is they weren't counting leases as part of capital invested. So guess what companies that adopted EVA started to do? They stopped buying assets and started leasing everything. It made their capital invested drop. It made the return on capital look really good. And they walked away with these huge bonuses. So I'm not saying consulting firms are doing this deceptively. I think they have the best of intentions up front. But my problem is, if you focus on a short-term metric, you also have to keep your eye on the big picture, which means you have to look at the rest of the pieces in your DCI. Any final questions on value enhancement before I show you what you found on your analyses?
Quick question on the voting versus non-voting valuations. So the non-voting valuation I get is just the value, basically,
the
without voting. Yeah, status quo value, no voting rights. Then the voting shares, you do your control valuation, which is basically just the probability times the value delta from owning the company. And then if you add those two...
No, don't add it. Just take the value control divided by just the voting shares. That's
right. Yeah, I know. So I get each equation. If you take a firm that it just has two distinct share classes, one economic rights and one voting rights, and then you add the two valuations of those separate shares, do you get something that is mutually exclusive or a value that would line up with anything else? Or this is just...
Right, because there's only so much equity. The value of equity you get from a DCF doesn't change depending on how you slice and dice. So you decide to give one class of shares dividends and the other class of shares voting rights. All you're doing is taking that same value of equity. So DCF doesn't change based on whether you're voting shares or non-voting shares, dividend shares and non-dividend. How you divvy up that equity will depend on how you structure those shares.
Got it. So if you're doing a two-class company, you do your DCF, and then you would carve your equity value based on the probability of control and the value delta from.
Exactly. Okay,
got it.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Right, so, professor. Yeah, go ahead.
A quick question. So in cases like Facebook and Google, where voting and non-voting shares are trading at similar prices, is it always a good idea to get the voting share just to have that optionality? If
the only problem is in Facebook, it's very difficult to buy the voting share, very illiquid, because most of them are held by Mark Zuckerberg and a few people. Google, you can get class A shares. So if you can get the class A shares, I would. The trade-off in many, many companies, especially as you go to lower profile companies, is the voting shares will be less liquid, higher bid-ask spread, more difficult to get, more transactions costs. So you got to decide. I would prefer the voting shares, but if I have to pay a 30% premium for the voting shares because bid ask spread is wide and the liquidity is dried up, then I might say, look, I'll settle for the non-voting shares. So sometimes practicality might drive you to the non-voting shares. You know who else is voting in non-voting shares? Berkshire Hathaway. But for a very different reason. The non-voting shares were created because, you know, what a traditional Berkshire Hathaway share trades for, it's like, six digits?
Yeah.
So the non-voting shares were created for people who wanted to buy small pieces of Berkshire Hathaway. So they come with no voting rights. Kind of ironic when you think about Buffett and corporate governance and what he believes about those.
Thank you.
So let's talk about your company. So let me first list the companies that were picked by the most people to buy. I was surprised. The most picked company was Peloton. Five of you did Peloton, four did Zoom, four did Netflix, four did Beyond Meat, a lot of tech companies, right? Now, one of the questions I've always been asked is, why do I allow multiple people to value the same company? Do you see why? Because right there, I've listed the four people who valued Uber. First, the prices don't match, which tells you that they were all done on different dates, which can happen, right? I mean, the 2240 must have been done almost at the end of March, maybe early April. So you can see the prices are different. The DCF values are clearly very, very different, ranging from 48 to 19.5. Well, different stories. The pricings are very different depending on who you price Uber against. Uber is a really difficult company to price because who exactly do you compare them to? And the recommendations are two buys, one sell, and one hold. You know, that's why it doesn't matter that four of you could be valuing Netflix. You can tell four very different stories. And do I think this is some sign of weakness in value? No, it's the reason you have people buying and selling. Now, I've never believed that I own the story for any company, and you shouldn't either. You have a story, you have a value, you make your judgment based on your value. But it's not my business telling you what the story should be and what the value should be, because we each need to own our own investment decisions. So let's see what you found in your DCF valuation. So as I said, I've been doing this for 30 plus years. I have these numbers for every group, every class I do. And this semester, we had a lot more overvaluations than undervaluations. And that's true in the corporate finance class as well. Originally, I'd said it was the reverse, but it's true in there. And the way you can see this is this part is the undervalued, this part is the overvalued. I think 62% of companies came out as overvalued, 38% were undervalued. And all I'm doing is comparing the DCF value to the median company. And the median company in this class was overvalued by about 12%. The average was higher because it's some outliers. Some companies really, really overvalued. But there were some undervalued companies. About, as I said, 30-something percent of the companies were undervalued. In fact, the first quartile, the companies were undervalued by about 21%. Something to remember, even if the market you believe is overvalued, doesn't mean that every single stock is overvalued. Any questions on this particular graph? So that's across the 200 plus people who turned in their numbers. I think everybody but seven people in the class turned in the numbers. Here were the most undervalued stocks. So basically what I'm looking at is the percentage difference between the price and the DCF. So some of these companies, I don't know very well, ASOS, China Mobile, both look like China, are not companies I'm familiar with. Lufthansa was a surprise to me. Now, the person who valued it believed it's worth 16.37 euros. It's trading at 7.95. I do need an airline for mine. United was actually right below. The question is how much Lufthansa actually shows up twice. Now, it's slightly different prices. Some of this does reflect the fact that with all of these companies, you're looking at 2019 numbers. And with any airline, we don't know how much damage 2020 will create. But actually, it's interesting that you have three airlines on this list. And I would classify Virgin Galactic as an airline. It's kind of a leisure business, you know, flying to Mars. But yesterday, I bought this this ETF called JET, J-E-T. It's actually four major US, it's basically an airline ETF. So I bought it because I think collectively airlines are undervalued. I know that goes counter to what Warren Buffett said 2 weeks ago, but no, Warren Buffett has his views, his stories, and his judgments, and you and I have to make our own. Now, Capital One showed up as, undervalued. So these are your most undervalued. Incidentally, Virgin Galactic was undervalued, but the person who found it undervalued wasn't quite ready to pull the trigger. So it's a hold, nine buys and a hold. When you look at the most overvalued stocks, these are the most overvalued again on a percentage basis. I don't know who did Shopify, but that looks horrifically overvalued. Marriott, very overvalued. Ameren, I'm not familiar with the company. But Shopify again shows up twice as overvalued, you know, by two different degrees. Again, am I going to go crazy and sell short of these stocks? I wouldn't. But again, if you feel confident enough about the overvaluation, you can lock it in for the long term. No harm trying for it, right? So I was looking for stocks that showed up on the undervalued and the overvalued list, because that sometimes happens, but I couldn't find it. There was no overlap this particular year. Robin?
Oh, sorry, I was on.
This mic was on. So that's the DCF part. Then I want to kind of take attention. I mean, as I said, I've been doing this for a long, long, long time. So I've been able to track what undervalued and overvalued stocks have done. Remember I asked you for buy and sell recommendations? I've been comparing buys and sells via S&P 500. You see, why did you stop in spring of 2009? Because I have to get some time, right? DCF is supposed to be long term. So I don't want to do this on, what did the spring 2019 class ask me to buy? It's interesting, across time, the buys have always outperformed, on average at least, the sells. No. But even the sells often make money. So for instance, spring of 1997, the sells and the market were pretty close, but the buy, so there is clearly some value in this buy versus sell. No. And you're saying, what am I going to act on it? I'm going to make a deal with them. Every semester that I teach this class, I buy one stock, and I buy one stock on that undervalued list. Okay? So the undervalued list, I'll buy one stock, but on a condition. And so if you're one of the people with your company in the list, here's the condition. If you put a buy and you have that undervaluation, I want to hear from you that you've actually bought the stock. Don't give me this hedging of, I don't have the money to buy the stock. If you're not buying, then I'm not buying, because if you're willing to put real money behind your recommendation, that will be the stock I add. You're saying, what if multiple people email me? Then I'll read your DCFs and decide which of your three I want to pick across. But I'll make that promise. If you're willing to put real money behind your buy recommendation, I'll put some money behind your buy as well. So, I do it not because of any, clearly it's worked over the long term. Incidentally, as I look at what's caused it to work, on average, 60% of all buy recommendations make money, about 45% still beat the market. So basically there's a difference between the 60 and the 45, but even the sell recommendations have beaten the market simply because we've been in this bull market, at least for much of this period. The excess returns on small cap and emerging market company buys is higher than the excess returns on large market cap companies, perhaps because your story has more resonance. But it's a very skewed payoff, which is every time that I track these buy recommendations, it's not that every buy makes money, but one or two of the buys account for the bulk of the returns. For instance, Apple was one of the buys in 1999. No, it actually lost money the next year, but over the next 10 years, it made so much money that the 1999 buy group got pulled well above the market. And finally, stocks that are both undervalued and underpriced do better than stocks that are just undervalued. That's why I would strongly suggest that you don't make this about, make this an either or. You know what I mean by that? Is I believe in DCF, therefore I don't want to do pricing. Why can't you do both? Because if you can get a double whammy, it seems to work better for you. Incidentally, if you think about the pricing part, I'll remind you again that the keys to pricing are the four-step process. Define, just because Anna Kournikova knows what the PE ratio is, doesn't mean you and I have the same. So make sure we're talking about the same multiple. Describe, don't fall for rules of thumb. 8x EBITDA or 6x EBITDA is not always cheap. And now analyze, remember that every multiple has embedded in it assumptions about growth and cash flows and risk. Try to back out what those variables are. And when you compare, try to find a way to control for differences. Whether you use a regression or not, you need to control for differences. If you remember, I asked you what multiple used, and basically a lot of EV multiples. In fact, if I look across what you picked, I think about 60%, maybe more than that, 65% of you were using some variation of EV. The 22% PE ratios, 10% price to book, and there were other multiples that I will find out as I look at your reports. But a lot of EV to EBITDA and EV to sales, which is not uncommon because those seem to be the multiples of choice even among analysts. Now, one of the things I asked you for was your pricing based on your multiples and comparables, and I compared your DCF value to your price. So this is basically DCF versus your price. And it actually turned out that at least in your class, at least for this group, know, the DCFs gave much lower value than the price. So in about 60 to 65% of your cases, your DCF number was much, much lower than what you got as your pricing number, which is consistent. You think the market itself is overpriced, you know, that's exactly what you'd expect. So again, troubling component of this semester is that you're finding that your DCFs are yielding lower values than your pricing. But looking at the pricing, here were your most underpriced stocks. Okay, so basically all I've done is compared your pricing to your price. So Wayfair, for instance, the pricing you got was 237.94. Right? As I said, I just report your numbers, so don't even look at me. So you turned in 237.94, or you either made a typo and meant to type 37.94 or 237.94. I compare the price to your pricing. So these are your most underpriced, but notice that there are 1, 2, 3 cells and 1 hold in there, which means that your DCF gave you a very different answer. So this is a scenario where the pricing said was massively underpriced, but some of you overrode the pricing, so I'm going to go with my DCF, completely okay. On an overpriced basis, your most overpriced stock was MGM. Now pricing, you know, where the price was $15.59 and you got 44 cents per share. Now Zoom, 155.4, pricing was 661. But these high growth stocks, if you're getting a really low pricing, NIO and Tesla show up there. One reason is because you're taking a regression from a mature sector and plugging in numbers for a very young company using today's numbers. Again, there's nothing for you to fix on your project, but if you get a really low pricing for a young company, one way to kind of get around the problem that your existing revenues are small and your margins are negative is you do a forward pricing. Okay. I don't want any of you to redo anything, but if I were pricing a Zoom rather than pricing it based on what do the margins look like now and what are the revenue, what do the revenues look like now, I would take the year 10 revenues and margins I have in the DCF, which I've already done, plug them into the same regression, and you will get a more reasonable pricing for many of these young companies than plugging in today's numbers. Now, I did ask some of you to try an option model if you had a lot of debt and your money losing. There were 33 companies where this was true. And in those companies, the option value that you got gave you a premium of it. In fact, for companies like MGM, where the DCF value was negative, the only way you could get a value per share was by using an option model. What's the option? The option to liquidate. It's coming from the fact that you have debt and the debt is not due right yet. So the option model was not for all of you, but for some of these companies, at least distressed equities, that's basically where it can help you. So after you had all these numbers, your price, the DCF value, the pricing, I did push you to make a recommendation. I said, are you going to buy, sell, or hold? And I know if you thought about that moment, you'll never be sure. You say, I'm going to wait until I feel sure. It's never going to happen. You have to make a decision, accepting the fact that the uncertainty will continue. It's also about faith. We talked about what you believe about markets. Are markets going to correct their mistakes? And finally, that, you know, it depends also on whether you're putting all your money in one stock or you're willing to spread your bets. One reason I feel more comfortable buying or selling is I know that this is not the only stock in my portfolio. If it's going to be the only stock, of course you're going to be paralyzed. So here's what you found in terms of buys, sells, and holds. This semester, there were 45 buys, there were almost 93 sells, and there were a lot of holds, a lot of chickens in this class, not willing to pull a trigger. I guess that's the nature of being in a crisis, but sells outnumbered buys almost about 2 to 1. And you can look across time at that ratio. It's obviously varied across time, but I think the biggest, you know, ratio of buys to sells was, you know, fall 2011, spring 2001. Coming out of crises, you're more likely to see this. But actually, sells outnumbering buys has been true in 4 of the last 5 years. But this year, you're almost 2 to 1 sells outnumber buys. So you don't have to answer this question, but this is a question I asked you at the very start of the class, and I promised you I'd answer. Ask it again, which is, hey, you've tried intrinsic valuation, you've tried pricing, and I want you to think about what you feel about these approaches, because I don't want to sell you on DCF, because it works for me. I like it, but that doesn't mean it should work for you. I wanted to think about the experience of going through this process and how comfortable you felt with your numbers. And remember, that comfort level will increase as you work more and more with this approach. But ultimately, it's your choice to make. Nobody should force you to do intrinsic valuation of pricing unless, of course, it's your job. And it's perfectly okay if after the sixth or seventh company you buy, you say, why am I doing this? I'm just going to buy ETFs and index funds. It's a completely healthy choice. And also, I pushed you to think about stories. I know I pushed you a lot in your DCF. Tell me what your story is. No, because I think if you're a storyteller, I think you want to get enough comfort with the numbers that you can, if I asked you what the return on capital is, you're not completely puzzled. If you're a number cruncher, if I ask you what's your story again, you think through the story. Work on your weak side, because as you went through this process, you probably recognized which part of valuation came much more easily to you. Okay. Work on the part that did not come easily. So if you were a liberal arts major or a history major, I know the numbers were torturous going through these numbers. But remember, this is what you're paying. I don't know how much you're paying for an MBA. I want to remind you. This is why you came back to business school, not to be able to write even better reports with the great pros, but to be able to work with the numbers. And if you're an engineer, you're back in business school, you didn't come to know how to put in mechanics and equations. You know that already. I think you came back to strengthen your storytelling side. So work on your weak side, because ultimately that's what's going to determine whether your valuations pay out. So I'm going to leave you with some not very profound advice. Don't take any of it off. So first, it's every time you have a crisis or there's uncertainty, people tell you the world has changed. The fundamentals don't matter. The more things change, the more they stay the same. It's always about the fundamentals. If you've read my blog post about the crisis, I'm on my eighth one and I'm going to post it this week. One of the things I keep trying for in these posts, it's not for others, it's for me, is to try to rediscover the fundamentals. When you're most uncertain, you want to go back to basics. Second, it's so easy in valuation to get lost in the details, right? So those hundreds of line items in DCF just distract. Focus on the big picture. I don't need six line items for working capital. I just need to know how much you reinvest to grow. So focus on the big picture and get perspective. Third, you go out there, people will tell you stories. I did this, more stories about a great payoff they got from a great investment. Anecdotes mean very little. Ultimately, you've got to look at across the spectrum at all of your experiences. And just because you've experienced doesn't mean that you have knowledge, which is great because you can catch up with somebody who has 40 years of market experience in 4 days. Because the fact that you've experienced three previous crises doesn't make you any better equipped to deal with this one. No, keep your perspective. It's only a valuation. I remember about a decade ago, at the end of one of these valuation classes, the second year MBA came up to me. She was a history major from Yale, and she said, if you're a history major from Yale or a history major from anywhere, you take the strategic MBA. Do you know what that is? You pick classes with the word strategic in the name, and you can go through 2 years without ever seeing a number. And she ended up, I think, by accident in the valuation class, and she turned out to be really good at it. At the end of the semester, she comes up to me and she says, I never thought this would happen, but I have a job as a sell-side equity research analyst. I said, my condolences. No, I said, my congratulations. And she said, I'm really scared. I said, what are you so scared about? She said, what if I make a mistake? I said, be glad you're not a brain surgeon. A brain surgeon makes a mistake, somebody dies on the table. You make a mistake, what's the worst that's going to happen? Somebody gets a little richer. Somebody else gets a little poorer. Just make sure that somebody else who's getting a little poorer is not you. Think like a Marxist. You move some wealth around. The world hasn't ended. Move on. Don't take any of this stuff too seriously. It's only numbers. It's only evaluation. Yeah. And finally, if you're ever given a choice between understanding everything there is to understand about valuation and being lucky, guess which one you should pick? Don't even think for a moment. Pick being lucky. I hate to let you in on this truth, but this is a business. Investing is a business where luck dominates skill and knowledge. If you're lucky, all will be forgiven. If you're not, you're completely and totally screwed. It was brought home to me by my mother-in-law when she came to visit in 2000. Now, my mother-in-law became an avid investor in the 1990s, which to me should have been a sign that the market was topping off. but I kind of missed that sign. So she would drive us crazy all day long. She'd watch the financial news channels, the ticker tape. Every time it went through, she made it a spectator sport. Go Cisco, go, convince that this was pushing the stock price up. And all she would talk about what was in her portfolio, what was out of her portfolio, what she wished was in and what she wished was out. And then she mentioned that in 1999, she bought Qualcomm, one of the great stocks of 99, up 600%. And I was impressed. And I asked her, Judy, how do you pick Qualcomm? And the minute I asked this question, I knew I shouldn't have, because she told me. She told me she picked Qualcomm because it owned MCR. And I said, that's not Qualcomm, that's WorldCom. She says, Qualcomm, WorldCom, what's the difference? I said, you picked the wrong stock. You actually meant to buy the stock that owned MCI, you'd have lost 40%. Instead, you pick Qualcomm, which is rhymes with it, and you made 600%. You know what? She wasn't in the least bit phased. I was afraid to ask her after that why she owned Cisco. Afraid the answer would be, I really like the vegetable oil, which is Crisco, or Saturday Night Live, which is Disco. But after she left, I did try a strategy out. Pick a stock in the news, pick one that rhymes with it. You know what, if I made a lot of money, forget about this DCF stuff. This entire class would be about driving stocks, but it didn't work for me. So try to be lucky. So if you're superstitious, you find that you buy coffee at the same Starbucks every morning, your stocks need to go up, keep going to that Starbucks, even if you drive 2,000 miles. So if I have a parting thought for you, be lucky. And thank you very much. I know this is not the way you wanted this class to play out. It's not the way I wanted it to play out. I wanted to see you in class, and I wish we could have done that. But I hope that even though we met online, that you've been able to get what I hoped you'd get out of this class. Yeah. So any final questions before Jessica?
Yep. Professor, I had a question about pricing. For money-losing companies, when you use like growth rate 10 years from today,
the low growth rate. So you got to put yourself almost entirely at the end of your 10.
Right. So wouldn't that give you a multiple 10 years from now and not today's multiple?
So you know what you'll have to do, right? To complete the pricing, what do you have to do? You have to multiply revenues in year 10 by that multiple. And then what's the last step?
You discount it back. I didn't do that in my report.
That's okay. Don't worry. As I said, you live and learn. This is not something that's a mechanic. It's not mechanically what you did was perfectly okay. The reason your pricing was so low was probably because you were forcing it into a process where the numbers really gave you low pricing. So this is the only way to get heft on your pricing, and it reflects the intuition. Nobody buys Zoom because of how much money they made last year. You buy Zoom because of what you think they will do in the future. And the pricing reflects that perspective.
Okay, so it's not really necessary to discount it back to present day.
Well, it kind of depends on your
perspective.
You compare that pricing then to the value today and you tell me to go buy the stock, I'd be very, very worried, right? Because as long as you put your buy recommendation on that pricing, you're okay. But if you hung a buy on that pricing, then I'd be a little more wary.
Okay.
Sammy?
Thank you.
Yes, Professor, it was a question that I've emailed you to. Assuming that my valuation ends up being very close to the current price, is there some kind of a buffer that we can say if it's within 10%, 5%, or 20%, is it worth pursuing it or not?
It depends on what your opportunity set looks like. If you have 50 stocks and then you have to pick only five, then you see, this is a margin of safety that value investors use. And the reason I've never understood how it can always be a fixed number is, first, it depends on if there are lots and lots of undervalued stocks, you can have a much bigger margin of safety, right? If you have a lot of money, so basically it depends on what the opportunity set looks like relative to what you have to invest. So if this is your only investment and everything else looks undervalued, I take a 5% undervaluation. But if this is one of 50 companies and I can find a 25% undervaluation, I'd rather get the 25%. So unfortunately, there is no one answer that can cut across people, because it depends on who you are, how much you have to invest, and what else you found. to be undervalued.
And so in this case, I've done my valuation and I did submit it. And until now, I feel like sometimes I feel I was very optimistic and other times I have mixed feelings about my own valuation.
Always
like
sure.
It's, maybe I was too optimistic and sometimes no, maybe I was too pessimistic.
Because you've just played God. Of course you should have mixed feelings.
I can't. Okay.
Eric?
I just wanted to say bye, so I'm waiting for everyone to say bye.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you, Professor.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.